back up and you look at some of the reasons that people struggle with substances, the first is certainly genetics, impulsivity, difficulty with self-regulation. But what has happened over the course of the pandemic is we've internalized everything. And we know once you internalize, you ruminate, don't get out of yourself, you're less empathetic. That is the problem with the lack of connection we're seeing.
Welcome to the Mindfulness Experience Podcast. My name is Keith Fiveson. On this show, I had an insightful and lively conversation with Dr. Fred Munch. He is the president of the Partnership to End Addiction. He's also a clinical psychologist that specializes in developing remote coaching and digital interventions to help individuals and families prevent and intervene in problem substance use. Fred has focused much of his life on developing, researching, and managing technology-based addiction applications and telehealth solutions for private, nonprofit, and academic sectors. I had an insightful and frank conversation with Fred about the state of addiction, drugs, use, stigma, psychedelics, and the role of technology and mindfulness to help find balance in an unbalanced world. I hope you enjoy the show. All right. Hey, here we are with Dr. Fred Munch. Fred, it's so good to see you. How are you doing? What is up, Fred? What's going on?
First, it's great to see you too, Keith. It's great to be with you. I'm just a lot of gratitude. I'm doing okay. Work is still meaningful. Family is still meaningful. Having a good time. Still engaging with life, and I'm glad that we're all making more connections now because things have been a little hectic over the last several years.
So yeah. They have been really, really, really strange. There's this huge shift that we've seen, and you've made some incredible shifts over the last few years. You're now the president of the Partnership to End Addiction, right? And have you seen any kind of increase in the overall usage and the overall stress levels? This is kind of like I think we're at a huge precipice here where we've got to start taking matters, really seriously. What do you think? What's happening in your world?
It's interesting because overall, general use, particularly amongst young people, is going down, and it went down during the pandemic, and it's not surprising because the reinforcers for youth use in particular. Were not there. So the kids weren't going out. Peers are the number one influence for initial use. We saw reductions in alcohol, cannabis, you name it, we saw reductions. Where we didn't see reductions overall is problem use. So if you already had a problem or were experimenting and had access to substances, we saw that things got worse. So the people calling us were not calling for early use as much as, oh my God, my child has a problem or my loved one has a problem. And then the other, what we also saw was a significant increase among adults with alcohol use, which is they were at home. A lot of the restraints around use were taken away. They could wake up in the morning and they could be a little hungover and get to work by 9 o'clock just by turning on Zoom. Sometimes we saw a significant number of people reporting having drinking earlier in the day. And so that existential angst was there. With youth, they turned to devices. With adults, they turned more to alcohol. We saw more of, I think we haven't seen anything yet because we know mental health concerns amongst young people precedes substance use.
Right.
And right. I also think that, you know, kids are going out more. Mm-hmm. Things are mm-hmm. changing. And right. and family members are more lenient. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. But, you know, certainly existentially, we're dealing with something very different. And I think it's many of us, including myself, are reevaluating what we're doing here, what right. we're trying to do and what we're trying to figure out. And substances are a great way to not think about that.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, we've seen the stress and trauma and the abuse certainly over the last couple of years at an all-time high. And now that things are seem like they're opening up a little bit, you know, in the drinking, drugging, eating, sexing, food disorders, you know, all of those things have yep. certainly been up. And some people really talk about the root causes of a lot of the addictive behaviors, and the behavioral disorders are really very much around connection, you know, connection. And that's been a real problem over the last couple of years. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree with it. I think, you know, that, you know, connection is certainly one part of it, positive connection. Mm-hmm. When you back up and you look at some of the reasons that people struggle with substances, the first mm-hmm. is certainly genetics, impulsivity, mm-hmm. Difficulty with self-regulation, and that's across the board. That could be that mm-hmm. there is a component of that has nothing to do with whether you were taught to take the mm-hmm. next M&M or mm-hmm. not take it. There, mm-hmm. there's genetic differences. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the self-regulation piece is we use others to help regulate us. Mm-hmm. We use others.
We co-regulate.
To yeah. help. Mm-hmm. We co-regulate. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there we see with young people, they will mm-hmm. co-regulate. And the best predictor of youth is whether your friends are using. So I don't ask young people when I speak to them, how much are you using? I ask them all about their friends. Mm. And the same mm-hmm. is true of connections in a positive way. And so if we use connections as a proxy, mm-hmm. We know that there are positive and negative mm-hmm. connections. Mm-hmm. But what has happened over the course of the pandemic is we've internalized everything mm-hmm. in a negative way, not mm-hmm. not a positive way. And mm-hmm. we know once you internalize, you ruminate, mm-hmm. you don't get out of yourself, you're less empathetic. Mm-hmm. And that is the problem mm-hmm. with the lack of connection mm-hmm. we're seeing.
So, you know, this whole idea of rumination, you know, my work around mindfulness is really very much focused on breath work, on, you know, how do yep. we, how do we respire? How do we inspire? How do we aspire? How do we go ahead and perspire, you know, how do we sweat our pursuits? All of those things are really important. And the breath work, I think, is so important because it really helps us to, you know, self-regulate ourselves and really get some space in between those gaps. But also from a neuroscience viewpoint, it helps us to really quiet down the default mode network part of our brain, which really is that self-referential rumination side of the brain. Have you seen some yep. of that in your work in terms of how people self-regulate and really, you know, quiet down their you know, their self-chatter, if you will?
Yeah, for sure. So as you know, Keith, I have a long history with mm-hmm. breath work. I was the director of development at a company called Stress Eraser, which was heart rate variability biofeedback.
Yep.
And we did a number of studies, and what we saw when we did imaging studies was a reduction in activity in the ACC, you know, mm-hmm. where you're getting that, you know, one is the ACC is sort of the conduit for a combination of impulsivity and rumination. And, mm-hmm. and by reducing the activity, you're just reducing the overall sort of automatic processes that happen that start to mm-hmm. Create autonomic dysregulation, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so what I've seen is the breath work mm-hmm. is the number one preventative, the most efficacious preventative tool mm-hmm. that we can use mm-hmm. To physiologically relax both mm. our brains and our bodies. And we don't use it preventatively nearly enough. We use it as a safety behavior, right? Mm-hmm. If you're stressed, mm-hmm. you'll start
take a breath.
To breathe yeah. slowly and yeah. take a breath, which is fine, mm-hmm. but it's not getting at sort of the underlying to create regulation, because we also know when people activate the vagus nerve, they are more likely to be engaging socially. They're more likely to be empathetic. There's so much literature with respect to creating autonomic balance through breath work that it is clearly the one intervention that if we could get everyone to do a combination of breath work, exercise, and some cognitive reframing, we can just walk away.
Right.
And we're
right.
done.
Isn't that great? So really, I mean, we talk about the neurological, the physiological, the biological framework that we're really all walking around with. And, you know, it doesn't have to be woo-woo, right? I mean, it's just, it really can be very, very simple. You know, you breathe, you move, you share, you go ahead, you ask yourself the question, am I really thinking that rightly? You know, and maybe you check in with someone, you have a conversation. I mean, you know, they don't have to be like, you know, like you have to sit in meditation for 20, 25 minutes either. I mean, you know, you can do these things wherever you are. You walk and talk, right?
And I think the walking and talking is part of the problem, is that we need to be intentional. And it's so hard to be intentional about this.
Right.
It's so easy to do, but you have to know to do it. And you have to engage in the intentional, effortful behavior to do it.
Right.
And we see this over and over in behavioral health intervention, which is the ability to start is the hardest part of the behavioral health intervention. And it's hard. It's hard. It's like having a craving and giving into that craving, which is, people don't understand why someone will dump out a bottle of vodka and then 5 minutes later run to the liquor store after they dumped out the bottle of vodka. So you were fine. What just happened? Automatic processes are hard to overcome. That's why I love people like Danny Kahneman, you know, all of his amazing work on thinking fast, thinking slow, and how we build in effortless interventions and how we trigger that behavior change when it's so hard to do.
Well, you know, you're talking about the habit loop, and really I always say it takes 21 days to make a habit and 3 days to break it. So, you know, if you're noticing that you're breaking your habit, you know, go ahead and at least on the second day or the third day, start getting in action and start doing something, you know, because there is that negative bias and it can go off the wall. You had mentioned something about, you know, the effortless work around that. Now you're doing something with a company, Vagus Labs, right? And you're really talking about, you know, this whole idea of effortless passive stimulation using vibration, light, and electric stimulation. Can you talk to that for a moment? Because that sounds to me like the better mousetrap in some way. You know, I mean, if I could just sort of plug in, you know, turn off and tune in and, you know, just kind of go on that highway, you know, I would sign up for that. That sounds great. Can I do that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, let's make that our marketing pitch, but unfortunately, it's certainly not a panacea. But, you know, just like I was saying, you know, when you're there's a certain amount of dysregulation, it's very hard to resist craving. It's very hard to resist rumination. It's very hard to then move towards pro-health, pro-mental health behaviors. And so what we learned a while back, and we started writing patents, you know, soon after we got some preliminary data, that we can use vibration and light and electrical stimulation to mimic the effects of therapeutic breathing. Mimic the effects on the autonomic nervous system as therapeutic breathing. Now, it's not as powerful as therapeutic breathing, but we can use the frequencies associated with optimal outcomes, both for activation, balance, and relaxation, that we use in therapeutic breathing, and use external stimulation to create that feedback loop in the autonomic nervous system. And what we found is, you know, it's not as if you're going to, you know, be angry, depressed, and all of a sudden you're going to be going, hey, everybody, how are you doing? But what you'll be able to do is take that additional step. So, you know, for example, we've done some pilot work with people who have difficulty socializing, either because of autism spectrum disorders, because of anxiety disorders, and they report being more less threatened and more able to open up and socialize. So it's that little trigger that can then trigger more, because we know whether it's the addiction literature or whether it's the depression literature, is the overwhelming majority of people just need a little help. And if we can do that non-pharmacologically and give someone that boost, that trigger, that stimulation to get them engaged, that we can stop the negative feedback loop physiologically, they can then start to take both physical and cognitive and emotional action to better themselves.
So is this like a, you know, the ability to go ahead and monitor the cardiovascular system, and then based on where you're at that particular time, it sort of does a little EFT, a little, you know, a little tapping or a little vibration or a little sound, or, you know, what, you know, do you have to get wired up for this? Do you wear a watch? Do you, do you put on a headset? What do you do? I mean, how does this work?
So when we did our pilot study, so it's just a vibration watch.
Okay, a vibration watch.
Most effortless way. That's it. That's it. A watch, you know, you can do it with the Apple Watch. It's really hard to manipulate the Apple Watch in terms of vibration, but it's a good example. We did it, you know, in different places on the neck, on the wrist, and we found that, so there's there's two ways to think about this. One is that where there's a feedback loop where you're actually measuring heart rate variability, for example, and then triggering intervention based on where someone is. So is it high? Is it low? Is it dysregulated? Whatever that might be. The other is just to intervene, which is people are remarkably aware of their state once you ask them to become aware of it, right? So we were not aware because it's not in our consciousness. It's not. But once you ask, are you stressed? Are you relaxed? Are you balanced? People can give you a pretty good idea. And so what we've done is to say, you know what? Let's make this as simple as possible. Let's do a you know, 5 second vibration at one frequency, 5 seconds at another. We're creating a 10 second cycle, like a 10 second breath cycle at 0.1 hertz. And we're just going to leave it at that because people are saying, I want to be balanced. I want to be more social. Now, the next phase of that is to have the full feedback loop. So when your heart rate variability is incredibly low, you're not moving, which means you're not exercising. How do we then trigger the intervention? And the same goes for depression. Well, what do we see is low heart rate variability, but overall low stimulation in the bottom body, you know, low galvanic skin response. There's a depression of movement, and we can use different frequencies there, similar to breathing. So a six second cycle to activate the autonomic nervous system to create some sympathetic engagement.
I love that. I love that. It's, you know, it's we're, I feel like I've entered the matrix. You know, I feel like, you know, really. So the next thing is I go into the tube. I'm in the nice warm, you know, I'm in the nice warm liquid, you know, I'm wired up, you know, and that's it. I mean, this is where we're going if we're not already there in some respect, right?
It's fascinating because, you know, there's an intriguing part of this of what is that like? You know, we've tried to use this as an opportunity to get unengaged people engaged in the world. Rather than think of this as a panacea, rather than think of this as the end, we think of this as the beginning to engage with others. And that's why if you look at the literature on social disengagement, it's associated with autonomic dysregulation. If you look at Asperger's and autism spectrum disorder, one of the clearest indicators is autonomic dysregulation. And what happens is when someone gets in a social situation, they fear, there's a threat response that someone goes into. So they become more dysregulated. Mm-hmm. So what do they have to do? They have to disengage to regulate themselves. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do is to create that autonomic balance of drugs without anything. So then someone can engage with the world. Right. You're not going to have a good time with what we're doing if you're sitting by yourself doing nothing.
Right. And you know, when I start talking about the matrix and all that, it's kind of, you know, kidding around a bit, but I think that there is a real, I think that there is a need for assistance. I mean, you know, the reason why people are drinking, drugging, eating, sexing, spending, whatever, is because they are dysregulated, is because those things actually do work, but they work to the point that the individual isn't able to go ahead and actually themselves breathe into whatever the issues are and help themselves to go ahead and activate the parasympathetic nervous system, go ahead and get themselves online, go ahead and be more pro-social, as you say, and involved in their own lives. So they become dependent, right? They think that there is a dependency there, not necessarily, you know, biologically, there may not be a dependency there. It might be just an issue of them connecting in to the moment and connecting in with themselves. So let me ask you along that line, one of the things that I'm aware of is we've seen shifts in the laws and regulations, specifically around the use of cannabis and the use of psychedelics as it relates to PTSD and, you know, anxiety and stress and trauma. What are your thoughts about that? Mm-hmm. I mean, do you, because, you know, here is, I've looked at a lot of the data on that and, you know, people are talking about, you know, major shifts in consciousness, major shifts in awareness. I don't necessarily think that's a panacea, but I do think it's an opening, if you will, for people to go ahead and become more aware of the issues that they have. And we also have seen some issues around being able to go ahead and quit alcohol and quit other opioids and so on and so forth. What's your data show?
Yeah. So, you know, unfortunately, I'm just citing the literature. Mm-hmm. We do not have our own data.
Okay.
But I can give you a combination of what I've seen in the literature and my own personal opinions about this. I think the most untapped opportunity is in traditional psychedelics, not and I exclude cannabis from this, in terms of the initial treatment process, in terms of integrating psychedelics into treatment. For addiction treatment and or any self-regulation treatment, frankly, for that matter, anything where we're struggling with our impulses. The literature is very strong, the preliminary literature. I think as someone who's enjoyed reading historically about addiction, you know, many people know Bill Wilson experimented significantly with psychedelics and, you know, was shunned by the community he started. I'm a huge fan of Bill Wilson, even though I did start out in the rooms. I left the rooms. I still am a big believer in 12-step. But I think there's amazing opportunity. And as someone who's experimented with psychedelics many years ago, 30 years ago, I see the opportunity. I think it opened a different level of consciousness, and that was without guidance and understanding and reading about guided trips, guided therapeutic interventions. I would say the combination of psychedelics and the new wave of technologies, for example, even virtual reality, augmented reality, as well as tactile stimulation protocols. I don't think we've seen anything yet. And I'm super excited. I think cannabis, the data is not there. I think people want the data to be there. And anecdotally, what I would say, aside from some of the randomized controlled trials where you see epilepsy, right? It's helpful in treating epilepsy. As a harm reduction approach, we have certainly anecdotally see people who are on opioids or other sub or alcohol for that matter, use cannabis. Particularly older adults who where for example, if someone asked me, if you're an 18-year-old, would you rather me have a drink every day or take a gummy every day? I would say you should have one drink every day, hands down, based on what we know about what happens to the brain.
Right.
If you're 65 and you ask me the same question, I'd probably say take a gummy every day, you know,
right,
based on this. And so we're seeing a lot of older adults shift from alcohol to cannabis. But this is all with the caveat of, I have no clue. There's not enough longitudinal data out there, particularly with the THC levels that we're seeing in these cannabis products.
Right, right, right. You know? Well, you know, and that's, I think that's, I think the other side of that, which is, you know, really important, and we haven't talked about it, is the spiritual, the ethnogen component of it. You know, I'm now in a psychedelic assisted therapy program. You know, it's a year long, and I've looked at, I've done, as we had Dr. Andrew Tartarsky on the show, as I told you before, he's now doing a whole program around psychedelics and addiction. And, you know, one of the things that I'm very aware of is the sacredness of these ethnogens, the sacredness of the tools there, you know, as opposed to, let's say, alcohol. But even alcohol was a whole other thing. But, you know, what is the intention? You know, what is the set, the setting, the intention, and what is it that you're looking to get out of it? You know, if it's just a social thing, or it's just a, you know, a recreational thing, well, you know, you may not get the desired results that you're looking for, because there is no intention. So it's set, setting, intention, you know, guidance, and then integration. You know, what is it that you learned, and how are you going to integrate that into your life? So those things, I think, are still, you know, especially now that we've got the big pharma coming in, we've got a lot of other organizations coming in that really have no desire to do any of that sort of setting and intention. You know, they're really about making the money, never mind the sacredness of it. That's the sacredness, is the money, right?
And, you know, it's something you just brought up, Keith, about, you know, you're in a training program, and I didn't know that. That's amazing. That's amazing. I, you know, love to chat more about this top line, which is the importance of a guided professional with this. I mean, as someone who, you know, struggled with heroin addiction throughout my early 20s, you know, I thought it was a great idea to get a bunch of acid, go down to Tulum when you could stay there for a dollar a night, and go and sit on a pyramid overlooking the water, having a panic attack, you know, by myself, because I wanted to create a spiritual experience, and it didn't work.
It didn't. So, you were blown away, but in the wrong direction.
Exactly. So I do think. I'm in full agreement, and I'm someone who comes at this where I'm working with family members, and particularly young people, and I see the opportunity for that spiritual experience and that connection with young people as well, and I'm excited to see what's coming down the pipe.
Right. Well, you know, I really appreciate your insight and your candor and your honesty and your openness around this, specifically in the work that you're doing in the partnership to end addiction. I know that you've struggled certainly with heroin addiction, and in one of your articles, you've talked about the stigma, and you know, you call this the whole stigma around calling addiction a disease, and you said that it may increase the stigma, and you said to talk like this, and as I said, you know, we were talking about before this issue about that it actually reinforces potentially the addiction itself, if you go ahead and you look at it as a stigma rather than a usage, potentially a usage disorder. Carl Hart over at the Columbia University, a professor over at Columbia University, uses heroin on a fairly frequent basis to go ahead and, you know, to go ahead and just chill. And he microdoses on it and he uses it. And, you know, he's trying to go ahead and look at the stigma as well. Can you talk to this issue around stigma and calling this a disease and or an addiction? You know, what is that? Is it time to change the language, in other words?
I think there's a lot to unpack, and I guess, in terms of the concern with a disease is more about how it's perceived by the general public rather than individuals. I'm less worried about what some people call the abstinence violation effect. Like, oh, if you have a disease and you say you have a disease and then you take a drink, that you're going to go out and do it. You know, I think that's more of an issue with a traditional 12-step model, that we should rethink lapse, relapse, what that means. And we understand that more rigid-based interventions where you don't have to think so much. You don't have to put so much effort. It's just all or nothing can be very helpful for growth because you're so focused on it. It's like, that is just something I don't do and I'm not going to do it. So I think there is a place for it. I think that when you, something where you're really working on a continuum and there's so many individual differences between different individuals. Carl Hart is clearly a freak of nature. He does heroin every 10 days. He said, and he does it, and he says he's calculating when he does it. That is something that the majority of people, the 20% or the 15% of people who are significantly genetically predisposed, add another X percent who have a history of trauma, where it takes an incredible amount of ego strength and willpower to do that. If you are someone who is vulnerable. And we saw that from the opioid crisis, right? Which is naive people taking opioids, not realizing they were becoming dependent and feeling very different from other other people, you know, in terms of, you know, I apologize, someone is just knocking on my door. Them being so different than others. And I've known plenty of people who, when I was in high school, I started to use with, who just stopped. I didn't. I didn't. I had to go to treatment center after treatment center. I have to, you know, go to X methadone program all this time, you know, get arrested, lose friends. If we don't think of this as individual differences and we don't treat people in terms of a model of personalized care, I think we're missing the point. I think Carl Hart's missing the point to say this is okay. I think it's naive. I think it's ignorant. I also think it's naive, not necessarily ignorant, but naive to say this is a disease and this is all this, because other people don't necessarily see it that way, but to say my brain's a little different than yours and I've taken a substance and I'm going to be rewarded at a completely different level that you are. And that's going to make me speak drugs in a way that you would never do. Whether you call that a disease or not, I don't care. But my brain is incredibly different from yours when it comes to opioids. Not when it comes to other drugs either. Like, that's the other thing is, you know, one drug is all that. That's not true. I was in the rooms for 10 years. When I went in, I said, you know what, I'm going to start drinking after a couple years. And after a couple years, I was like, I'm not ready to do that. And then after 5 years, I pretty much stopped going to meetings. I was like, I'm going to start. And I was like, you know what, I'm not ready to do that. I don't feel comfortable doing that, even though I never had a problem with alcohol. And then after about 10 years, I said to my wife, I said, I'm going to start drinking again. She said, you know what, can you do me a favor and wait 6 months? And I said, sure, happy to do that. Because she's like, I don't want you to act impulsively. I know you want to. So I did. And then I started drinking again socially. And then I stopped at some point because I did think I went, actually, you know, this is the first I'm saying this to a public audience. But there was a moment where I got worried for about 3 weeks, where I was like, I'm having some difficulty. And you know what it was? And this is a larger question about mindfulness recovery connection, is I lied to my wife. I hid the fact that I had I didn't hide the fact that I had a drink. I hid the fact how many I had. Mm. And I lied.
Mm. Mm.
And that's one of the things I think we don't talk about enough with addiction, which is egosyntonic versus egodystonic.
Mm.
And for me, the second I lie is the second I'm addicted.
Mm.
Is the second I am in a place that is going to take me down a path of darkness.
So the shame that binds, right? It's that whole idea of the shame that binds. That's
exactly.
Really in a lot of, and that's really what we're talking about in terms of the stigma, is the shaming and that shame that kind of binds us into a, you know, I'm not worthy, I'm not good enough, I can't show up, I can't be my authentic self. You know, I'm hiding, I'm doing whatever. And I really think that intentionality, which is why a lot of the work I do around mindfulness based, you know, whether or not it's breathing, whether or not it's being present, the whole idea of mindfulness based presencing is being present to whatever is rising. And you talked about that, you know, we talked about that whole idea of, you know, knowing that there is a stimulus or some sort of a trigger, you know, and whatever that trigger is, it could be a tsunami, it could feel like it's a tsunami. And, you know, how do you breathe into it? How do you ride it? How do you go ahead and really not let it overtake you so that suddenly you're swallowed. So I know we're at the end of our time here. You're doing such great work over at the Partnership to End Addiction. You're doing this other work over at Vegas Labs. I really want to be a guinea pig for you somehow. If you can get me into, if you can wire me up, Dad, you know, please help me with that. That would be wonderful. I'd love that. You know, I'm ready for the chip. I'm ready for the chip.
Can't wait.
I'm ready. You put the chip. Put the chip. You know, put it right up there. I'm fine with that. So, how do people find out more about you? You're well published. You're out there, you know, how would people get a hold of you? And kind of, if they have children or friends or whatever, you know, and they want to go ahead and work with you or your organizations, how do they find you?
I don't see clients anymore as a psychologist. Mm-hmm. I stopped. I've really focused on building technology-based interventions, and particularly at the partnership, we help the helpers. We serve family members. We serve parents, concerned significant others, and I think the easiest way to start that connection. And so I focused on effort. Right, everything I do is about effort. Mm-hmm. The program we built at the partnership is you can simply text JOIN to 55753. You can go to our website at drugfree.org, but you can text JOIN to 55753 if you're a family member and you want to support someone to either prevent or overcome addiction.
So text JOIN to 55753. JOIN 55753. And or go to the Partnership to End Addiction and the website again?
Is drugfree.org.
Drugfree.org. Okay, great. And then Vegas Labs, website is very cool up there. What's that?
Yeah, that's vegaslabs.com. And we're just getting started. We're building a device. We're licensing our technology to a few people. You know, as one of the co-founders, I really have more of a back seat right now. I help on the scientific side, but there's other people running the show. And I'm just grateful that, you know, to do some really, really fun things to make it easier for people to go where they want to go in life.
Everybody's got to get that watch. Everybody's got to get wired up. We all have to be regulated. You know, we'll be little, autonomous. What are they? Automons? What are they?
There you go. And I'm going to have the switch. Watch out.
It's so nice to see you today, Fred. How are you? I'm feeling very good today. How are you?
I'm going to look at your vocal prosody, Keith, over the course of the podcast over the year. And we'll know when you got the device on.
It's been very nice. Thank you so much. Yeah. So this has been really a pleasure, Fred. I really want to thank you again for, you know, joining and sharing your wisdom and your knowledge, which is really quite vast. And I hope you'll, you know, I won't put you on the spot, but I certainly hope we get the chance to go ahead and revisit and talk again about this stuff. There's so much to unpack and so much to really help people with, so much knowledge here. So.
Well, Keith, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for all you're doing, pushing the envelope, thinking of new ways to shift behavior and consciousness. We need to get out of our own heads, and we need to get that guidance and then go deeper into our own heads once we have the right tools to go into our own heads. And I think that's what you're doing. So really grateful for all you do as well.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate that so much. So we'll catch you on the other side.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you for being a part of the Mindfulness Experience podcast. I hope you enjoyed this frank and honest discussion with Dr. Fred Munch. I also hope you gained some insights about how community technology and connectedness can help support individuals that are struggling with substance use. Please follow the podcast to connect to future ones as well, and also subscribe, leave us a review, and suggest some topics that you'd like to hear. Connect with us on our social media platforms, visit our website at workmindfulness.com for more mindfulness experiences. Thanks again. See you on the next show. Take care.